Hello and welcome to the Tribcast. This is State Senator Kel Seliger. For all of us who've wanted to know where D.B. Cooper really is after all these years, here's your host, Reeve Hamilton.
Thank you, I guess, though not for ratting me out to Senator Seliger. I'm Reeve Hamilton, reporter with the Texas Tribune, here with the Tribcast for the second full week of December. Joining me is CEO and Editor-in-Chief Evan Smith.
Hey.
Reporter Becca Aronson.
Hello.
And reporter Kate Galbraith.
Hello.
It's a much nicer group of panelists today, huh?
As compared to who?
I like Becca and Kate much more than Ross and especially Philpott.
His nickname is especially.
Especially Philpott. No, I think this is good. I'm going to learn something today.
Yeah, well, it's always nice to have a change of pace.
It is.
You know, we're trying to ramp up into the new year on a good foot. But I know you probably want to go back and revisit our discussion about the speaker's race from last week.
I just want to tell Becca that you were right about David Simpson all along.
I know.
You saw something into the future that David Simpson would be a significant player.
Well, he caused quite a stir last session. It was my first session, too, and he caught my attention, so...
Becca was with Brandi Grissom, the co-author of a profile of David Simpson that ran in the New York Times and in the Tribune.
So I spent a lot of time interviewing him, getting
you
to
did.
Know him. Very interesting fellow.
Are you surprised by this? By this development where he is now the sole challenger to Joe Strauss for speaker?
Somewhat surprised, but not that surprised.
S-O-L-E or S-O-U-L? He's a pretty soulful guy, Reeve.
Yeah, which is he challenging?
Yeah. What's your sense of this?
Well, I mean, I think they're both very different candidates and they bring different things to the table.
Yeah.
But, you know, Simpson got a lot of attention last session for not going along to get along. And so I think that's what he's running on. He's saying, I'm going to shake things up.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, if he can grab the Democrats, which who knows, then, you know, it could be an
Of course, the challenge, though, on that, as Ross pointed out this week in a story he published with us, is that the criticism of Strauss has been largely that he was elected with the help of Democrats. And so here you have Simpson coming out of the blocks on the speaker's race saying, I'm going to respect the rights of the minority, by which he means the Democrats, and I'm going to reach out to the Democrats to get me elected speaker. So if Simpson is elected speaker with the help of Democrats, why is that materially different than Strauss being elected speaker with the help of Democrats? I'm not sure why. The conservatives who were mad at Strauss for using Democrats as his route to the speakership would not be similarly mad at Simpson.
Yeah, well, you also get people saying that, you know, for folks that have said that Simpson is not experienced enough to be speaker, his experience is not significantly different from what Strauss's was.
Strauss had served for two terms, I believe,
right,
when he became speaker. Simpson's now served for one. We live in an era when the lack of experience is the new experience. Right, people like the fact that you're not a creature of government for years and years when you take power, and that's the whole thing.
But you know, I mean, the upshot of Simpson filing and Hughes getting out and endorsing Simpson, does that really change anything about the speaker's race? Because when it was just Hughes Strauss, we said it wasn't much of a speaker's
race.
Well,
it changes a couple things. First of all, Simpson goes into this with twice the votes that Hughes had. So Hughes had himself. Simpson has at least Hughes and himself.
Has Simpson said
endorsed
that he was
himself?
Voting for himself?
Do you think he might vote for Strauss? That's a
We haven't asked him that.
So
right?
Simpson, let's assume that Simpson has his own vote. He has Hughes' vote, and there are rumors around the Capitol that he has quasi commitments from a bunch of other folks, provided he can deliver. You know, veteran members. There may be some freshmen who support him, but neither Simpson nor Strauss has put out a list. Neither has put out numbers, which gives the other side ammunition. Well, Simpson's not a serious candidate because if he was a competitive candidate, he'd put out a list. And then the conservatives don't like Strauss say, well, Strauss hasn't put out a list. That means he's weak. We don't really know. We're not going to know. But what's different is if Hughes had stayed in the race, they would have divided the ABS, anybody but Strauss, vote. And now that Hughes is out and it's just a straight-up Simpson versus Strauss thing, the people who ultimately don't want to support Strauss have one place to go, and that's with Simpson. And the question is, from a math standpoint, can Simpson make this work?
But it's hard to imagine that a lot of Democrats would go with Simpson, who is far to the right of Strauss.
He's significantly more conservative than Strauss on some issues, but the thing about Simpson, as you know, Becca, is...
I mean, he's different than Hughes, isn't it?
Yeah.
He really does work on principle. So there's some things that the Democrats might be able to get through if they can convince him it fits with his
principles
of how government should work.
Well, I think what Becca is saying, you jerk, don't throw her under the bus. What Becca is saying, I think correctly, is that Simpson is not the kind of guy to to embrace party orthodoxy at the expense of anything
else. I mean, he voted against the party on a number of issues last session, and, you know.
There's no question he's conservative, but he's also a little bit unpredictable. As I think I said last week on the podcast.
Doesn't that make it harder for him to get the support to be speaker?
But I think the point is,
I mean, like, take the puppy mill thing that happened last session with Sinfonia Thompson. She's a Democrat. He got her on a procedural thing and kicked the bill out, but then he ended up working with her, and now they're pretty good buddies in the ledge. And she's a Democrat.
But he's not the first Republican to work with a Democrat.
But I think the point here is this is not a hardline Republican who says to the Democrats, you're irrelevant, you don't exist.
No, he says, Simpson is making a point,
of saying, I'd be willing to work with you. He flies by his own set of coordinates, as we said last week on the podcast. And that makes him a more interesting and more unpredictable sort. At the end of the day, Strauss is likelier to get the majority of Democratic votes than Simpson is. He just is. And then the math becomes problematic for Simpson because he basically has to win this in the Republican caucus, and I'm not sure that that's possible. We cannot pronounce this race over. If you had talked to us on December the 12th of 2000 and was it 7 or 9 that Strauss became speaker? It must have been...
It was December the 12th of 2000. I mean, December the 12th, 2008.
Well,
Going into 9.
So if you had talked to us on December the 12th of 2008 and said, do we think Tom Craddock's going to be speaker... in the next session, we would have at that point probably said yes. The Polo Road coup.
That's why we didn't record the Tribcast that year.
That's true. The Polo Road coup didn't really take place until after this. So, you know, who knows what twists and turns are going to take place on this race. I think you got to say that Strauss got the embedded advantage here, but we'll see.
Do you think this maybe was a plot that Strauss and Simpson hatched on the Vanderbilt campus back in 1980?
Yes, Reeve, you went to Vanderbilt. You're awesome. Okay, good.
As did they.
Private college snob.
Prerequisite for being a speaker, I think.
Now, let the record show that there were five of us in this room, including the mute Todd Weissman over there, who is just working the dials. The number of public university graduates in this room is zero.
Todd
went to USC. Todd didn't go to Todd's a private college guy, so we can't really.
We're supposed to not acknowledge Todd's presence until the end. So let's move on.
His entire employment at the Tribune has been one long not acknowledging Todd's presence, hasn't it?
We should move on to what really has been the other big political / health discussion in the state this week, which is the dealings with CPRIT, the Cancer Prevention Institute of Texas?
Research. Cancer Prevention and Research. That's the R.
Yeah.
Reeve.
CPRIT. Right.
We're finding the cure for cancer.
Basically, CPRIT has found themselves in a bit of a scandal, and now they're the executive director.
Do we even know that it's a scandal yet?
We don't know that it's a scandal yet. We know there's one $11 million grant that they're not quite sure how it got approved, and so they're investigating.
So it's a scandal.
So it's a scandal.
You have the Attorney General's office is investigating, the Travis DA is investigating, and the head of the organization has resigned.
We don't know that the DA is investigating. We have outside groups that are pointing a very strong finger saying that there are political interests.
Well, I think the public integrity unit of the Travis County DA's office is involved.
Oh, okay. They've been notified to investigate.
Kate's the level-headed grown-up in this office. Do you think that the fact of an investigation makes something a scandal?
Not necessarily. I mean, just look at the Ethics Commission's filings. I mean, people file things to the Ethics – or file complaints to the Ethics Commission and investigates.
Turns out not to be anything.
Right.
We don't actually know what's going on here at CPRIT.
No, but there has been enough
– neither the people at CPRIT, apparently.
Enough of a stir that the head of the agency resigned yesterday. And
I'll acknowledge that – it's not a good sign when the executive director resigns and the people on the board say, thank you for your service. You know, the optics of it are not great.
Yeah, and Perry, when I saw him yesterday at the fetal pain press conference, he said that he supports personnel changes if that is what it needs to ensure the integrity of the institution. So,
well, CPRIT is one of the, you know, the creation of CPRIT was one of the big sort of feel-good stories of Texas. They committed more money than anyone else to cancer research.
Yeah, we put $300 million a year into the program.
For 10 years, right.
So it's sort of a shock to the system to see it. I mean, it seems to be crumbling at the moment.
Everything Lance Armstrong touches. Wasn't he involved? He was heavily involved in getting CPRIT passed, right?
Yeah. Well, I guess we'll have to check in next week to see if it's a scandal. Maybe David Simpson will become the executive director and it'll change everything.
And drop out of the speaker's race. That's it, yeah.
But you mentioned Fetal Pain. And what be other than a great metal band, what is Fetal Pain?
So, yeah.
That's a good band name, I would agree.
The governor yesterday, he announced that he's going to support the Fetal Pain measure in Texas in the upcoming session. Perry did. And he said some other things that he would support in regards to an anti-abortion agenda. Basically, the Fetal Pain bill would ban abortions after 20 weeks. Right now, we women aren't allowed to get them unless they're at risk of their lives after the third trimester. So it would move it up about 7 weeks. The bill is being backed by Texas Right to Life, and it hasn't actually been filed yet, but they're working on it. And the director of that group, Elizabeth Graham, said it wouldn't include an exception for victims of rape and incest. So,
which is consistent with Perry's evolved position on abortion during the presidential campaign. He moved to the right of himself on abortion and said, I no longer am for the exceptions for rape and incest, which puts him in the same place as Greg Abbott and Ted Cruz and a bunch of other Republican elected officials. My observation on this, Becca, and I wonder if yours is this too, Texas is not alone in doing this, but a number of the states, and Texas may be in the lead, are doing everything they possibly can in a world in which abortion is legal to make abortion's legal status irrelevant.
Well, and they're not being secretive
and that's,
about that.
No. They're not secret about it at all. I mean, that's exactly what the intention is right. that each year let's create more restrictions to further reduce that.
We can't change the law, but what we can do is basically make it almost impossible for anyone to avail themselves of the fact that abortion is legal.
And that's why the abortion sonogram law they passed last session has actually been fairly successful, because it's created burdens, especially in rural areas, that make it more difficult for women to actually access abortions.
Explain that.
So basically, it requires a physician to see the patient 24 hours in advance. And a lot of these places, they were doing medical abortions, which means a technician would perform the sonogram, and a physician could consult with the patient via telemedicine and then prescribe the medication. Now the physician has to travel there and actually physically be in the room to do the sonogram. And so because of the time requirements and the travel requirements, there's less time available for the women who need these abortions or say that they need them to actually have them scheduled. And so it's really about the logistics.
In some ways, it's kind of like voter ID. You know, the reason that voter ID was a problem was because there were so few DPS offices, it was onerous for people to have to travel the distances required to get an ID. In this case, it's onerous for the doctors to have to travel, and therefore women can't get the sonograms.
And for the women, because they have to do it in a time when they have 24 hours, plus then maybe a healing period or recovery period. So if you are a working woman, I mean, that makes it a lot harder.
What I think is so interesting is at a time when public and higher education, that's actually that's the governor calling to complain about the tenor of this conversation. at a time when we have huge challenges on public and higher education and water and immigration and healthcare and transportation, we shouldn't be surprised, I guess, despite those challenges, that we're going to find time for some of this other stuff, which may not seem like a, quote, emergency. I guess
an emergency for the people who are involved because, you know, they think that, or they are protecting lives of unborn children.
Right, but if you think about the emergency, and for them this is a serious issue, but if you think about the list of items that are on the minds of most people in the state, and when you say, well, what are the big agenda items going into a legislative session that we're going to talk about? You know, I shouldn't be surprised at this point that in addition to all the big ticket items that we always find ourselves confronting, and they're all on the list this time, the nature of our politics at the moment is that this sort of stuff kind of gets on the list too. He did not make it an emergency item, though, yesterday. Is that right?
No.
Or not yet, at least.
I mean, the bill hasn't even been filed yet, so we'll see.
Maybe he can't do that.
Yeah. I mean, one of the bills that has been filed, though, is by Dan Patrick, who's the author of the abortion sonogram law. And so he's put a measure out there that would further increase the number of requirements for physicians to be present while doing these early term abortions, which is the same thing. It would just increase the logistical burden on physicians and women.
But what is the science behind Fetal Pain? Isn't that still somewhat in dispute?
It's somewhat in dispute.
Is Fetal Pain a fair description of the bill? I mean, it sort of sounds dramatic.
That's what they call it.
That's what they're calling it.
that's what
yeah, the supporters of the bill.
The supporters of the bill. I mean, yeah. So, I mean, the American Medical Association says that there isn't really proof of fetuses feeling pain. That it's, I mean, it's kind of, you're not a fetus. You don't know what they feel. But they knew that they have nerve development at 20 weeks. And they react to stimulus at that time. It's, you know, it's a matter of debate.
Yeah, but, you know, do you predict it'll be an emergency item?
I do. I predicted it would be an emergency item.
I wouldn't be surprised.
I wouldn't be surprised. It's a way for the governor to connect himself with his supporters in that wing of the party, people on that issue who've always been very firmly with him. I think the question really to ask is not does he make it an emergency item in 2013, but is this a feint in the direction of either running for re-election in 2014 or running for president in 2016? I happen to believe it's the latter, as I've said before. I'm not persuaded he's running for governor despite what he said, but I think this is a perfect issue for him to claim some ground on the right with. If he goes into a presidential race in which there are more people thinking more to the center, so center conservative as opposed to right conservative, this is a way for Perry to put a flag in the ground on that end of the spectrum with a constituency nationally that will be impactful during the Republican primary.
Do you think if he was not – if his aspirations for higher office were no longer around following his presidential run, we would – be seeing the press conference he had this week?
Maybe.
Or this discussion?
I'm not saying he wouldn't be doing it. I'm saying that the practical impact of it, though, may be that it helps him with a certain base of the Republican primary electorate in 2016.
It helps him with a certain base, but a lot of the moderate Republicans are kind of shying away from abortion issues now. I mean, you have John McCain saying maybe we just shouldn't talk about it, even though I'm pro-life, so.
Well, a lot of the issue of exceptions for rape and incest obviously came up in a sort of detrimental way in a number of Republican races nationally.
Yeah.
But it gets to a question that someone asked me the other night. They were asking me, you know, after the election results, are we going to see Texas tacking to the center from where they were? And it seems to me like Texas
no.
will continue to tack
no.
to the right. Maybe not as quickly as it had been, but
it's the outlier. And it loves being the outlier.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is not no. I mean, it's no. No, absolutely not.
Don't take away Evan's fun.
No.
Yeah, right. Evan likes that sort of outlier.
I like contrast. It's contrast. I thought Donna Campbell's presence at the press conference alongside Perry was fascinating.
Yeah, and actually, I had never seen her speak before. I know you interviewed her.
I saw her speak from this close on Friday of
last
week.
I mean, she's an impressive speaker, to say the least. I mean, she commands her audience, so that was interesting.
Stylistically, she's about as different from Jeff Wentworth as you could imagine. The Senate is going to be an interesting place next
session. Yeah, it's going to be very interesting.
But this is also one of the big gaps between Wentworth and the Republican Party that came up in his election. I don't think it was really the deciding factor, but he's famously pro-choice,
or at least neutral to pro-choice. I think he may have been.
He's one of the great quotes you can get on pro-choice. He always says something like, "You know, I just don't think that hairy-legged men should be making decisions for women." Basically,
well, that's you can get more pro-choice than that.
Yeah. But
I always thought of him as a little bit more quietly as opposed to loudly in that camp.
I think it's openly. I don't know about loudly.
Well, there's no other pro-choice Republican that I'm aware of in the Senate right now.
So it's interesting that she would get out in front on that issue.
Well, she's also a doc. I mean,
she's
that's
a doctor.
Part
she's
of
an
what
adoptive mom. You know,
she has a child or more than one child adopted.
Mm-hmm. That's how she introduced herself. She's like, as an adoptive mom and an ER doctor, this issue is near and dear to her.
Well, what was your impression of her and her impact on
the legislature? Well, speaking of contrast, having Villarreal and Campbell up on the same stage was pretty much the opposite poles of the session. You know, she's got a lot of energy. I think she has a lot to learn by her own admission about the particulars of issues.
Yeah, she's open about that.
You know, but Villarreal doesn't mind throwing punches, and she was perfectly happy to take them and to throw a few of her own. So I did not find her to be timid. I did not find her to be unwilling to engage.
She also she has the highest seniority among the freshmen in the Senate.
Well, I think the interesting question there is going to be, is the race for her seat already begun? I was down in San Antonio to do this event on Friday with Villarreal and Campbell, and what I heard repeatedly was that either Representative Lyle Larson or County Judge Kevin Wolf, who's the son of the former mayor, or both are considering getting in a Republican primary whenever she runs next to challenge her. if for no other reason that San Antonio is having a bit of buyer's remorse as a city over not having a Texas senator representing the city who is from San Antonio. What they lost with Wentworth was not just a apparently pro-choice moderate Republican. What they lost was somebody who was from San Antonio. She's from New Braunfels. And I think that they're feeling like, okay, we got to fix this. And so there's already openly discussion of both Kevin Wolf and Lyle Larson running against her potentially in a primary, one or the other.
Lyle Larson, of course, refused to run last time when TLR approached him.
Well, again, what I'm hearing within San Antonio is that there may not be as much reluctance this time. So we'll see.
I should also say for former or current senator, but soon to be former Senator Wentworth, that his further argument is that he thinks that the pro-choice position is the conservative position because it's smaller, it's less government intrusion.
Hear that about gay marriage also.
Yeah.
Right? Two big hot buttons.
But what are some issues that you might expect to be higher on the emergency item list if you were going to prioritize them rather than fetal pain? Or maybe you think fetal pain should be number one, but what else on your beat should be on there?
Well, it's hard to compete with fetal pain. I'll admit that. But
Todd, tweet that right now.
There's always water, Reeve.
Well, actually, the problem
is
that
there's
not, right?
Yes.
Yeah, well, there's not always water.
Did you realize?
I was out in West Texas 2 days ago, and there was not a lot of water.
Yes, it has not rained here in Austin since, let me see, October 26, except for a trace, like 2 days ago. So that's bad. But yeah, so.
But even when it was raining every day, you said we were in a drought.
I know. I'm such a downer. But yes, will the legislature fund the water plan? Dewhurst, Strauss, others are saying that funding for water is very important. We need, you know, more facilities, growing cities, et cetera. And, you know, I mean, the other question that I'm hearing is the water plan the right plan? It's just kind of a compilation of, you know, the Dallas region wants X, the West Texas region wants Y, and so, and they all want money, but is there enough coherence to allow us to provide, to sort of authorize state funding for grants and loans and things? So
there does seem to be general acceptance of the Dewhurst proposed plan to take money out of the rainy day fund should it be available to seed the funding of the water plan. I've heard both Democrats and Republicans say, yeah, generally speaking, I like that idea.
Right. I think you mentioned $1 billion, which, you know, given that the state needs, according to the water plan, which again, is that the right plan, $53 billion, that's not a huge amount, but to start. So, I mean, I'm sure you wouldn't mind $1 billion, Reeve, but, you know.
We think we're paying him. he's getting up there.
That's right. But
let's not have that discussion on the Tribcast.
Paying you some of that Vanderbilt money.
But, yeah, other issues of interest are, of course, the power grid. You know, how are things looking next summer? I mean, you know, ERCOT, the grid operator, just came out with this report that said next year we're going to be below the 13.75% sort of target reserve margin. So that's actually worse than thought next summer. But the future summers look better than projected, but that's mostly because the state or ERCOT decided that future economic growth is going to be slower. So, so we'll need fewer power plants in the kind of distant future. It's confusing.
I thought nothing could slow Texas economic growth. We're just rolling right along. Well, I mean, you know, have any bills been filed on this stuff already? There's discussion of the funding the water plan, but you know, has anyone actually filed any bills to do anything about any of this stuff or power grid bills?
Yeah, I checked a month ago or so, and or right when the bills were filed, and people weren't filing very much. So
I expect Alan Ritter, the chairman of House Natural Resources, is going to file a bill to do the tap fee for water that he had proposed previously but didn't get passed, which would require individuals to pay a certain amount and companies to pay a little bit more and industry to pay a little bit more beyond that, and he suggested that after a period of time, it might generate as much as $26 billion toward some kind of a water plan. The question is whether in this environment where we hear repeatedly we don't have a revenue problem, we have a spending problem, there's going to be any stomach at all for revenue increases of any kind, including fees, which some people, but not everybody, are okay with. The tap fee, which is basically a user's fee, it doesn't sound onerous to the average person to pay a couple bucks a year to contribute to fixing the state's water problem. And yet there are some people who are so doctrinaire about revenue that they say, we don't want to even go there.
The big thing I'm watching for the session is the announcement of this new UT university and if they can get that going.
Have they arrived at a name? The rumor was UT Las Americas. Is that what it's going to be?
Well, at the big announcement, Sigueroa, the chancellor of the UT system, was calling it the University of the Americas in the Rio Grande Valley. Then they said there was no name
for
it.
Kind of a mouthful.
Some people that put out press releases and politicians were calling it University de Las Americas. It would actually be a big change for the...
So what happened? So it's UT Brownsville and it's UT Pan-American combined.
It's combining UT Brownsville and UT
Pan-American.
So there's
a reality show bake-off between Juliet Garcia and Robert Nelson.
That's exactly what I proposed. I said they should have a reality show to
vote
find
somebody
a new president,
off the island.
Put it on the Longhorn Network, which could use the ratings boost. And
what do you got against JV volleyball that you don't like to watch on the?
No, I think this would be a good lead-in to JV volleyball. But it's those two universities combined with the Regional Academic Health Center in Harlingen. So you have a campus in Brownsville, Harlingen, Edinburgh, and then administrative offices in McAllen. So it really would just sort of cover the Rio Grande Valley area with this one university that is in four locations.
And at what point does Aaron Pena become the president of this new institution?
I think we might see Aaron Pena in Austin more soon.
What do you know?
Just
spill, Reeve.
I've heard he's going to come hang out at all of our Tribune events.
Oh, great. No, Aaron, seriously, you're welcome. You're welcome to come, honestly.
But, the thing is that they've announced this new university and they've done this multiple press conferences and town halls around the Valley and in Austin. But it's far from a sure thing at this point. They need 2/3 of the legislature to approve the consolidation, and even then it's, they're...
Have you queried the chairman on this, Branch and Seliger, to see where their heads are at on this?
No, I haven't. I haven't talked to them. Mm-hmm.
That might be a good phone call to make.
I feel like you've been talking to Seliger every week.
I have. In fact, I miss him. It's been a week since I interviewed Seliger.
That's why we had him on this week.
That takes care of that. I just talk to him next week. That's fine.
Yeah. But, we'll see what happens. And even then, the whole point of doing this is to get them access to the permanent university fund, since those two schools have always been left out of that source of extra money, and to get that new university into the emerging research category, which is also sort of not exactly a guaranteed thing. I mean, the coordinating board would have to look at it and say, okay, it fits, but that's so far down the road.
Was this a big plan that you knew about in advance of the Regents meeting, or was it a surprise?
It was pretty much a surprise at the Regents meeting. They've been talking about it. UT Brownsville's been in this weird position where they're breaking up with Texas Southmost College that they've been in partnership with for many years. They're trying to figure out what they were going to do.
Mm-hmm.
But they just renamed their mascot. They've been sort of working on where to put their new facilities. And UT Pan American just got all these new signs around their campus that say UT Pan American. So... they've been moving ahead, both schools have been moving ahead as if they will continue to be their individual universities while sort of working on this. It sounds like this plan has been in the works for, a couple months. But I think it still caught a lot. They managed to keep the lid on it pretty well. It caught a lot of people by surprise. But that'll be a big discussion in the session for sure. Because then there are people that want a law school down there too. And they're saying right now they're going to get a medical school as part of it, which is also contingent on a number of funding things, speaking of getting money out of the legislature. But there are,
good, and by the way, good luck.
Yeah, multiple bills have already been filed to have a law school in the Valley, and it's harder to make the case for the need for a law school than it is for a medical school. And either way, there are problems with residency slots or jobs when you get out of it. So if they're already going for the medical school, it might have to wait a little longer for the law school. But should be exciting.
Anyway. Yes, as you can tell by the high level of energy on this podcast, it should be very exciting. I'm just waiting for Dan Patrick's vouchers bill on Monday to come out. Then we'll have that to talk about next week.
Yes.
Speaking of big items.
If you're invited back, you never know. It might just be Kate and Becca from now on. And Philpott.
Have I been fired? Awesome.
If you would like to take Evan's place on
please,
the TribCast.
Please, please, put me out of my misery.
Email tribcast@texastribune.org or with any other questions or comments. On behalf of Evan, Kate, Becca, our producer Todd, who now you know about.
Trojan Todd.
This is Reeve.
It was a USC reference.
I got it.
Get your head out of the gutter.
Thanks for listening.
K Kate gets most of my jokes.
Hello.
Is that true?
That's better.
No.